This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm pleased to have my guest today, Alan Wolfe, here in the studio with me. Alan Wolfe is professor of political science at Boston College and one of our leading public intellectuals. He's the author of about 20 books, the most recent being The Future of Liberalism, which we're going to discuss today. Alan Wolfe, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt.
Why should liberalism be championed today? Because that's what you're doing in this book. You're championing liberalism.
Yeah, I'm mostly championing liberalism for liberals. I didn't write the book to persuade conservatives to be liberals. If George W. Bush and Dick Cheney couldn't persuade conservatives to be liberals, there's nothing I can do. And in fact, they did persuade a couple, but most conservatives, if they're still conservative after these 8 years, then so be it.
I think they're kind of lost, actually.
Yeah, I was more interested in getting liberals to think more positively about liberalism, not to be so defensive about it, and to recognize that it's a great and glorious tradition and one that I think everyone should be proud of.
Why have they been so defensive about it?
Well, in part because given the way sort of American politics has evolved over the last couple of decades, liberals come to mean big government. And in this country, with its worship of the frontier and all that, that goes, you know, all the way back to Frederick Jackson Turner and the Wisconsin Historical Society, there's been this distrust of government. So to the degree that conservatives pick up on the idea that liberalism, like today, liberalism is socialism, you know, that puts liberals on the defensive. But liberalism has a long history. It predates the New Deal. It predates the progressive period in which your magazine was founded. And that history has been, I think, pretty much neglected in this country. And I wanted to bring it to life. It's the history of thinkers like John Locke and John Stuart Mill and really the great 18th and 19th century liberal tradition.
You say liberal politicians lack the courage of liberalism. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, liberal politicians don't like to call themselves liberal that much. Polls that show that Americans don't like the L word and politicians read polls, so that's where they go. You certainly saw some of this during the Clinton years with triangulation and Dick Morris and stuff like that. Now we're in the middle of this big economic crisis. It's a pretty good time, I think, to embrace a liberal agenda in a much more dynamic and positive way than we had under the previous Democratic president.
Alan Wolfe, do you think Obama is embracing that liberal tradition, and does he own the word or own up to the word?
You know what, Matt, I don't really care if he uses the word or not. That's, you know, I don't think he does, and I'd like it if he does. But to me, it's no big deal. He is a liberal. He's a liberal. In my book, I talk about liberalism as kind of substance, liberalism as temperament, and liberalism as procedure. Procedurally, he is, I think, doing as much as one can to restore the American tradition of due process of law and other liberal procedures that the previous administration abrogated. Temperamentally, the man is as liberal as can be. He's engaging, he's intelligent, he's open-minded. And substantively, he's proposing the most ambitious program since FDR and Lyndon Johnson. If that isn't liberal, then I don't know what liberal is.
You do have a critique in this book of progressivism, and since I'm the editor of the Progressive Right. magazine and this is Progressive Radio, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about that. What is your critique?
My critique goes back really to one of the greatest thinkers that influenced the book, German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who made this very, very famous statement that out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing can ever be made. And Kant wanted it to recognize the role that irony and indirection and unanticipated consequences play in human life. And, you know, the word progressive, which, by the way, I love your magazine and I've written for it and so on. The word progressive, though, implies to me, not the way you use it, but the way a lot of people have used it, especially Woodrow Wilson, and to some degree the Progressive Party of the 1940s, it implies a straight and direct path. You want to get from point A to point B, you go in the straightest way. And that bothers me. So, you know, my main objection is really to the violations of civil liberties and the Palmer Raids. You know, the progressive era has been described by one great historian as kind of ministers of reform, a kind of Protestant sensibility of the straight and narrow Christian path. And that's what bothers me about it. My favorite Christian, well, everybody's favorite Christian these days is Reinhold Niebuhr, who wrote about irony, and that's the kind of tradition I much prefer, the indirect one.
I mean, there's so many different kinds of progressivism, even going back to that early part of the 20th century. There's Teddy Roosevelt's progressivism, yeah, which was combined with an imperialism.
Right, and racism.
Blatant, and racism. Yeah. And there's Wilson's, who also was racist, and repressive of civil liberties. And then there was La Follette, who was neither, who was an anti-imperialist and was a champion of civil liberties. So those all kind of get blurred together. And, you know, these days, we at the Progressive Magazine try to keep up that old anti-imperialist and civil liberties protector view that Robert La Follette articulated, and we've just been walking back through the past 100 years, so it's been kind of fun. You do make some other criticisms of the left in the United States that I just wanted to air out with you and have a conversation. I, too, believe in a liberal temperament. I'm a believer in argument and discussion and conversation and civility. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of those. One, the current attack on religion by members of, I don't know if you'd call them the left, because Christopher Hitchens floats back and forth, but this criticism of religion, Paul Hawkins and others, Sam Harris. What is your brief against them?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, what is a liberal supposed to do about religion? On the one hand, some religious believers, not all by any means, but some religious believers are highly illiberal. They're sectarian, they're dogmatic, they're repressive. What does a liberal do when confronted with illiberalism? I think you have to respond liberally. In other words, I think the default position should be that in a liberal polity, there's room for deeply religious convictions, even those that are illiberal themselves. Now, fortunately, I think I might not say this back in the 17th and 18th century when religion had the power of the state behind it and was engaged in the quashing of dissent. But it seems to me that we live in a liberal world, much more than a world that is in the West, than a world characterized by religious orthodoxy. Liberalism has won its war with religion. We can be tolerant toward religious people. Now, in the third world, in the places where religious fervor is alive, I think there's a slightly different take.
One thing that you argue in here, that and I've read in your writings elsewhere, I think in the New Republic and the New York Review of Books, that you that sometimes liberals have gone too far, especially in some court decisions. And in particular, you talk about Roe v. Wade. You have a line in there where basically you say you can't force it on people. If people aren't ready to go, you can't go there. But I wonder about that, because the counterexample, and you also talk about it, is Brown v. Board. There are a lot of people in the South who weren't ready for Brown v. Board, and we forced it on them.
Right. No, you're right. I don't take the position that you can never force things on people against their will, because Brown v. Board proves that you can. In fact, in this book, I found myself doing something I never thought 20 years ago I'd be doing, and that is defending affirmative action. I was very critical of affirmative action when it first came down, and it struck me as illiberal. But the more I thought about it, the more I read thinkers like Mill and so on who never wrote about affirmative action, the more I came to see that affirmative action is very much justifiable along liberal lines.
What is your justification of it?
Well, affirmative action to me is exactly like using the welfare state. The welfare state, I believe, is a perfectly liberal innovation, because the free market cannot offer what it always promises, which is the two great liberal goals of autonomy and equality. And when the market doesn't do that, you need some help. Well, racism doesn't allow for people to fully develop their autonomy and to fully become equal with others. And because it doesn't, it's perfectly appropriate to use mechanisms to, because the goals are what's really important. Affirmative action, I think, is now with Roe v. Wade, I say in the book that the idea that a woman should be in control of her own body and make her own decisions is fundamentally a liberal idea. And I completely support that, a woman's right to choose that without any hesitation. But a lot of people are critical of the reasoning in Roe v. Wade. Catherine McKinnon is, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been, and so on. So what it really comes down to is the way to achieve that. And I do think that Roe v. Wade took some illiberal shortcuts to doing that and treated opponents of abortion. And some people on the left treat opponents of abortion as essentially so wrong that it's almost not worth engaging in debate with them, when I think we've all learned, or so I've certainly learned a lot from opponents to abortion. I think in general we've learned that abortion is a very serious matter that requires deep moral reflection, and that's been a contribution of those who rejected Roe v. Wade.
Are there some people you can't argue with or you can't discuss with?
You can't discuss and argue with terrorists, you know, with Osama bin Laden and his crowd, and I never would try, but that's probably the subject of another book. But yes, there are.
I mean, what about people in this country who are very conservative and are just kind of hostile to conversation or hearing other
people's
ideas?
Absolutely. I mean, I would have, you know, I spend a lot of time, I write a lot about religion, so I spend a lot of time in evangelical America, and I know evangelicals, including some prominent evangelical leaders, that are very thoughtful and very, very respectful of dissent. But I've met Pat Robertson. I know who James Dobson is. These are people that it's just not worth it. But to me, what's interesting about them, I think, is that their dogmatism, their sectarianism, doesn't come from their religion, but from their politics. I don't even see them as all that religious. I see them as political activists bent on imposing a right-wing agenda on this country.
Well, it is odd, they use their religious cloak to talk about tax cuts for the rich.
Whereas that in the Bible? To me, gives the game away. and my God, Matt, I mean, look at the Republicans in Congress since Obama has been elected, especially in the House. These are not serious people. These are not people that are putting for serious programs. I just cannot believe the level of irresponsibility. And when people are at that level, I don't know what the purpose is. You know, it's interesting because almost from the moment he was inaugurated, Barack Obama in the first few days was trying to reach out to some of these Republicans in Congress. I think he's learned better. I think there are just some people that are so off the charts that you're not going to get anywhere with them.
I mean, that either was a demonstration of his liberal temperament or of naivete, or it was a strategic, kind of gambit that I'm going to show people, I'm going to reach out, I'm going to anticipate that they're going to slap me in the face, and then I'm going to say, look, these people are unreasonable.
Well, if that's what it was pretty smart.
He's a pretty smart guy. I mean, I don't agree with everything he does, but he has been very smart along the way. You talk about the welfare state, but then when you talk about welfare itself, you surprisingly, to my mind, came to a defense of Bill Clinton's ending welfare as we know it. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, I think the crucial goal, that liberals have always argued for is the notion of autonomy or self-governance, that we should be in charge of our lives. I think there comes a time when a welfare system can create a level of dependency that strips that capacity from a person, and it's not something that we ought to put ourselves in the position of defending. And I think that's happened. I think it's worth trying to find alternatives to dependency. I think dependency is a condition that we should always be suspicious of. But now, under certain conditions, maybe you can't. And, you know, now that we're entering this and in the middle of this big economic crisis, you know, it might be that a liberal would say, well, now under these conditions, we need a lot more to help people to reach some basic level. But what Clinton was dealing with was a situation in which you were dealing with third and fourth generations of passing dependency from one generation to another. I don't think that's a good thing.
But I wonder, you know, doesn't that, in a situation like we're in today, and even back in Clinton's day, giving people 5 years and out, it gets to a point where, you know, they weren't getting rich on the system. Maybe they were dependent. That's a debatable proposition in and of itself. But certainly to give people some basic floor that they're not going to sink underneath as far as material levels, that would be enabling, or in the best sense, you know, liberty. And that's what you're trying to champion here.
That's right.
As far as substantive
liberalism. Broadly speaking, I mean, one of the main arguments of the book, and, you know, it's kind of an attempt to engage conservatives, or at least engage libertarians. Whenever I talk to libertarians or write about these things, I'm always told, Wolf, you don't understand. There's classical liberals, and they were good because they believed in the market. And then there's the welfare state, and that's bad because that's socialism. And I just reject that distinction entirely. The welfare state to me follows logic. John Maynard Keynes follows logically from Adam Smith. They're both liberals and they're both great liberal thinkers because they both wanted people to achieve autonomy. And in the 18th century, you needed the market to do that, to break the stranglehold of feudalism. In the 21st century, you need the welfare state to do that. So the welfare state is absolutely, in addition, the welfare state, I argue in the book, has very strong Christian roots as well as liberal and socialist roots. And it really is a reflection of the Christian idea of there but for the grace of God go I. So all these things, yes, you need a floor. Yes, you need all these things. But I think liberals have to recognize that what I call in the book the curse of the state, that the state is our friend. But, you know, states can cause problems, too. They can become excessively bureaucratic. They're very hard to get rid of once you get them in there. So we should have a liberal approach to liberalism.
I'm speaking with Alan Wolfe. He's the author most recently here of The Future of Liberalism, which we're talking about. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You know, I saw that quote in your book, "There but for the grace of God go I," and it seems to be kind of a reassertion of, you know, John Rawls's theory of justice. There's just another way of boiling down that, and you claim him as a primary liberal philosopher.
Yeah, it's actually quite amazing that just in the last year or so, Eric Gregory, he should get credit. I'll give his, he's a professor of religion at Princeton, discovered John Rawls's undergraduate thesis in the Princeton Library, and it's about religion. And even though he was Episcopalian, and he rejected religion during World War II and was an atheist for the rest of his life, but his first instinct, the origin of the whole Rawlsian moral philosophy, I think does come from his Christian upbringing.
And evidently Norman Thomas's too.
Oh, yes, Norman Thomas. And one of my really favorite and great writers who I try to bring to more prominence in the book was a British Fabian socialist named R.H. Tawney, whose book Equality is written out of deep Christian conviction. If I may, Matt, you know, back then at the end of the 19th century, it was the social Darwinists that were the most right-wing and the most atheistic. I mean, in the end of the 19th century, the right wing were atheists and the left wing were Christians. And it's all been reversed in 100 years.
And you, at Boston College, you run an institute on religion.
That's right. Now, Boston College is a Catholic Jesuit college. And boy, the Jesuits really embody a lot of the ideals that I'm talking about in this book.
Now, there are some progressives, some leftists here in the United States. My predecessor was one, Irwin Knoll, the great editor of The Progressive for many years, who would recoil in horror at the label of liberal, because he would say liberalism to him represented either corporate liberalism that was defending the capitalists who govern the society, the economy, and pollute the political system, or Cold War liberals that brought us Vietnam. And I wonder how you distinguish the liberalism that you uphold from those two slurs on liberalism.
Well, that's the tradition I grew up with. The corporate idea in the liberal state, James Weinstein's book. I think Jimmy Weinstein was in Madison when he got the idea for that book. I mean, this was part of the University of Wisconsin History Department studies on the left. You know, all these people were very, very critical. Corporate liberalism was the dirtiest word you could use. For me, actually, the great left-wing anti-liberal person besides Noel was Phil Oakes. "Love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal," one of his folk songs. In fact, I went back and got the words and to that song to see if I could get a title for my book out of it, but I couldn't find anything useful. So that's what I grew up
with.
You could
have called it "Love Me, I'm a Liberal."
But, you know, I think that all of this was written before we really saw what conservatism in America could produce. I mean, one of the big books that influenced me was a book written in 1955 by Lewis Hartz, The Liberal Tradition in America. And the idea then was we were all liberals. Well, no one really saw this, you know, the gold border stuff. That was so right-wing in the 60s that we all thought it was going to die out. It was a maniac. Well, now those people, you know, in fact, gold border looks like a moderate compared to the Republican Party today. So I think when we see this kind of concern, when we see Sarah Palin, we ought to have a lot more use for the word liberal than we might have in the 60s and 70s.
But as far as corporate liberalism, you don't cozy up to corporations in here. I mean, you criticize some of the anti-globalization folks too harshly, for my opinion, but it's not like you're carrying water for corporations.
No, I don't think so. Although, you know, I mean, again, the corporate liberal thing, you know, was such a dirty word, but you take an issue like affirmative action, corporations are way ahead of the law with respect to promoting diversity in the workplace. They, in fact, the number of corporate spokesmen say that if the government were ever to repeal affirmative action, they'd do it anyway. And, you know, you get funny things, Matt. Whoever would have thought that the FBI and the CIA and the military would become so good on race in this country compared to what things were like 50 or 60 years ago. But look at, you know, look at the military and the really extraordinary job it's done in promoting racial equality. It's, I never would have thought.
But how, Alan Wolf, do you wrestle with liberals who champion Vietnam, for instance? I mean, you have a quote in this book, yeah, The Future of Liberalism, where you say it does not have to become enthusiastic for war. That is, liberalism doesn't have to become enthusiastic for war because it views war as a failure in the quest for peace. Maybe, I don't know, you know, Truman dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Johnson in Vietnam. I don't know. That's hard.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. First, there are a lot of liberals that have been sort of rethinking Vietnam. Maybe we were wrong to have been so opposed to the war in Vietnam. Yeah, well, Michael Lind, I don't know if he's lived. I don't share that. I think the Vietnam War was an absolute disaster. Now we have the phenomenon of the liberal hawks, who are liberals, but who, you know, want a fairly aggressive foreign policy, protection of human rights, interventionism abroad, labeling things as genocide, even if that requires intervention and so on. I'm generally sympathetic to that, but I don't consider myself a liberal hawk. I worry about that kind of liberalism a lot. I would not be for military intervention in Darfur right now, even though a lot of liberals are. I think that we shouldn't be isolationist liberals. But I really do worry about a tendency of liberals to overcompensate aggressive foreign policy. Peter Beinart from the New Republic, he's now more or less repudiated the book he wrote. But that was an example of liberals, I think, going too far in the direction of a kind of interventionist foreign policy.
And that was for the Iraq War.
No, the Iraq War is a real lesson for liberals. You know, liberals can blame Bush for it, but there are a lot of liberals that supported it. And those who did, I think, really need to rethink why they supported it. My favorite example, I quote him in the book, is Paul Berman, who wrote a book called Terror and Liberalism. I just don't buy it. I just don't buy his arguments.
But is there a time when you could buy an argument for humanitarian intervention?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Probably should write a book about it. Probably will be the next book.
Well, you turn them out so fast, it may not be a problem for you, unlike for most of us. What is the risk reaction? You mentioned Sarah Palin, of reaction in the United States. I mean, we had an era where reaction was in power for 8 years of the of the most grotesque form. And yet, I don't think the risk of reaction can be undersold when the economy's so bad.
I'm a little more optimistic, I guess. So far, so good. I mean, there is a lot of populist rage out there, and you know that could take left-wing form, it could take right-wing form. You never know where populism is going to go. But I think most Americans are still, you know, I'm amazed they want to give Obama a chance and so on. There is a lot of anger. But, you know, I look back a couple of years ago. I should preface this. I'm often wrong in my predictions. So I made a good prediction, a correct one. So let me tell you and your listeners, a couple of years ago, everyone thought the big issue in 2008 was going to be immigration, that there's going to be a big backlash against immigration. And I interview a lot of ordinary Americans, and I said, no, it ain't going to happen. The country isn't that reactionary on that issue. And it never did happen. So will it happen now? You have to prove it to me. I'm not at all convinced. I sure hope, in any case, that we come through this without that kind of reaction. But yes, you're right. I mean, who could doubt that the emergence of a phenomenon like Palinism, you know, or the Republican Party's absolute inability to, you know, I write about liberalism. I'm a liberal writing about liberalism. There are a lot of conservatives writing about conservatism, and some of them are very thoughtful, and they're not having much of an impact on their own party at all. So I think that for the near future, the Republican Party is going to be led by extremists. One hopes that that means that they'll be marginalized. But I think you're right. Some crazy thing happened, you know, and all of a sudden you could find them.
I mean, that's the risk. I'm speaking with Alan Wolfe, author of The Future of Liberalism. On the one hand, I'm very glad to see this reaction, this populist reaction to AIG and to the bailout of the banks and Wall Street. I'm reading your book, I'm reminded about some of the unseemly aspects of populism. How do you wrestle with that?
I worry a lot about populist instincts in this country. I think, by and large, they've caused more harm than good. Now, you know, Michael Kazin, who's written about William Jennings Bryan, great biography, constantly tells me I'm wrong about that, you know. But to me, there's been a close links between populism and anti-cosmopolitanism and anti-intellectualism that I think are really serious. Obama, you know, understands this. It's been pretty clear since he's become president that he's trying to acknowledge the power of populism, but he's not trying to lead it, in a sense. He's trying to channel it.
He's being criticized for being behind it, but too far behind the curve.
But I think he recognizes that there are dangers there, dangers for the country, dangers for the Democratic Party, and dangers for him.
Your book is The Future of Liberalism, a common, almost cliche among some intellectual circles, certainly when the Republicans were in ascendancy, was liberalism's exhausted or liberalism has no new ideas. And I laughed when I read in your book your rebuttal to the point that the claim that liberalism has no new ideas. Could you share that with us?
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. My favorite example is this amazing book from 2004 written by the two editors of The Economist, the British magazine The Economist, called The Right Nation. And it was all this, you know, liberals have no new ideas and conservatives have all the great ideas. And so I haven't seen a good conservative idea, you know, in quite some time. You know, liberal ideas actually are some of the oldest ideas around right now. The crucial liberal idea, and this is what really the future of liberalism is about, is that liberalism is about human beings having a sense of purpose. That liberals believe that the world is under our control, that we're not determined by our genes, our world is not determined by God. The world is ours to shape as we want. And I can't think of any more profound lesson in a period of economic crisis than this. I mean, that to me is what was great about Keynes. I'm not an economist. I can't follow all the arguments of Keynesian economics. But what really impressed me about Keynes was at a time of tremendous economic trouble, he said, you know, there's nothing natural about this. This is no equilibrium. Human beings can change this. And deficit spending and all of those things were a way to change it. It's that fundamental idea that's so important.
And that gives an optimism to liberalism that sometimes people aren't really ready to buy into. And also it gets past the problem that a lot of people in times of recession suffer not only the economic indignities but the psychological ones, yeah. Which is to say they blame themselves. Do you think Obama's going to have a successful presidency?
I think he is. I think he's one of the smartest, most capable politicians that I've seen in my lifetime. I wish him nothing but, you know, good luck. It was an optimistic idea to say the future of liberalism. You know, you could say that's a very short book, but it's not a very short book. There's a lot there for Obama to work with, a lot there for all of us to work with, because finally it's not just Obama, it's us.
So we'll have to see exactly how long that book turns out to be. Alan Wolfe, author of The Future of Liberalism, thanks for being my guest.
My pleasure, man.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella, an engineer at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.